Wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
Atlantic Voice Podcast, I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
We're down in new basement studios by the lake. Sorry, I was a bit thrown off there because both of us, our voices... We need to warn our listeners that for the next hour, we might sound slightly different.
We're a little gummy.
Yes. Well, you're gummy and I'm runny.
Yeah.
Because apparently when I arrived, you told me that today the pollen count, the allergy
Not pollen. Pollen, no, none of that in the fall, but it's a high dust and dander.
Okay.
And that's because it really hasn't rained in a while and there's a lot of leaves and dry material. So I spent the day outside clearing leaves and so... This has not helped me. This is a new thing. I used to get springtime allergies. Now I seem to have these fall allergies, not severe or pain, but I end up being sort of like a little bit of a cough and a little bit of congestion all the time.
So like a 24-hour attack?
It goes on like continuously for weeks. It's just like I started taking one of those 24-hour antihistamines every day, you know, the Claritins.
Yeah.
I guess they also aren't antihistamines.
Yeah, that's what I've been taking. Yeah. So I am both dusty and dandy,
if
that's how it should be, yeah.
But I did see on AccuWeather or something when I was flipping through things, it had a very high count on dust and dander.
How do they work that out? Is there like some machine that you...
Science!
There must be some machine that goes and then the printout comes out. Like, yeah, I was amazed.
Sure, there's some dust and dander sensor.
Yeah, I mean, like Joe Local Weatherman will go, today the pollen count is such and such.
I mean, those pollen counts, they must do an actual thing, but unless they just basically say, you know, a situation is conducive to there being a lot of pollen, and so they tell you there's a lot of pollen.
So anyway, if you hear me sneezing sort of in the background, it's because I'm sneezing.
We're never very good, like there's a mute button...
We have a mute button on the microphone.
But I'm never sure if that works the way we have it set up. The one on the board works,
but the board works.
It's a lot easier for me to reach the board than it is for you. So
I find it's just easier just to sort of turn away and lean way back from the microphone. And it's
easier for you, maybe not easier for the listener.
Okay. All right. So anyway, on with the show.
Yeah.
We have a list. This is one of our regular shows because I will say this now. I'll promote this now and at the end of the show. Our big Christmas special is on the horizon.
That's right.
This is not
2 weeks from now and then 4 weeks from now or whatever we do. Sometimes we pack them into more closer schedules.
Hours of holiday listening, perhaps if you're traveling around.
This morning when we texted about getting together, I said, and what are we talking about? And you're like,
Yeah. But you know, that was my segue there. There are going to be hours of podcasts for you when you travel around.
Right.
At the Christmas holiday,
because
we're going to start off with some travel from the Thanksgiving holiday.
Yeah, maybe not. Yeah, traveling. I mean, just generally the holidays,
it's a
right?
Weak segue,
so
but we just
we're recording on the Sunday after Thanksgiving.
Yep.
And so I have just been up to Long Island, New York, visiting the family up there, and you know, some activities there. Your standard stuff. Turkey was quite good this year. Not that it's bad normally, but it was unusually moist. I was having a conversation with a mutual friend of ours about dark meat, where when he was a kid, when I was a kid, that was like bad stuff. Like, ooh, who would want the dark meat? That's too
weird.
When
you're a kid, yeah.
Yeah, but then we're now to the point where you're like, well, this dark meat is clearly the better choice. I mean, it's definitely closer to like duck and things that have more
flavor. I don't quite agree with
and, okay, defend. Did you even have a turkey at Thanksgiving this year?
I had two different turkeys, one on Thanksgiving and one the night before. Yeah, the one the night before was very salty. It was a pre-made turkey from somewhere, and it was just a turkey breast.
Meaning like it was cooked and you just warmed
it up. It was cooked and warmed up. I don't want to get too far down that road. When it comes to chicken, I've become a dark meat convert. But for turkey... I don't know. I don't like the dark meat on turkey as much as with chicken now. I love chicken legs and chicken thighs. And I'm like, I'll buy a whole load of thighs and make a curry or a stew. You can cook the heck out of them. I love dark meat on chicken. But on a turkey, I still feel the breast is the good stuff.
All right, then.
And here's another reason.
But like, I guess you should have some reason.
But it tastes better.
Well, it doesn't? I mean...
I think what happens with turkey, because the turkey is so big, when you get some white meat, you can get big steak-like chunks of it.
This is true.
And so I like just getting stuck into
it. It's much more likely to be dry.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think it has less... It's better with the gravy, maybe. I don't know.
But I think that's what it is, yeah. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I don't find turkey...
The turkey's really not that good.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good way to put it. It's not that good. Now, I've had fried turkey.
It's
that
not
was
bad
great.
Either, but it's no, just, it is.
I've had fried turkey. I have brined a turkey and roasted it. Mm-hmm. And I think turkey's one of those things, if you put the effort in, you can make something that's quite tasty. Mm-hmm. But I think to your point, you know, in the Premier League of fowl, you've got chicken, you've got duck, you've got goose, you've got all kinds of other things sitting up there. Turkey, it's never finishing top.
Yeah. So I have upstairs, I have a...
That's my opinion.
We were in the basement studio, so upstairs being where the refrigerator is, I have a Ziploc bag in which, when departing Long Island, I basically threw a bunch of stuffing in, just threw the turkey on top of that, and then I threw some ziti, because we had that the night before, and there was leftover ziti. Okay. So I just have a bag that's a mass of that stuff, and after we record, I plan to warm up some portion of it and eat it.
Well, I will say that about turkey. I think turkey goes really well with the day after... with other stuff that's lying around.
Yeah, well,
you know what I mean?
Sandwich, and cranberry sauce sandwich. Yeah.
And okay, I've now come to my position. I like the white meat on turkey more because when it's cold, I don't like the dark meat.
No, because the dark meat has, it's like saying the cold, you know, if it, anything that has fat to it, you know, when next day, unless you can warm it up gently and get it back to being sort of soft again, it's got, you know, chunks and stuff.
So that's my position.
All right, then.
Yeah. So there you go.
Anyway, so I didn't expect to be talking about turkey. I was mostly going to mention that while I was up on Long Island, we went to it's called Sky Zone, and it's a trampoline park, an indoor trampoline park.
Okay.
So you pay by the half hour.
So hold on. I'm going to let you finish. Sorry. Sky Zone. So this isn't one of those, because I've seen this advertised where you're floating on air like
skydiving. No, it's that's like the skydiving places, okay. Which there are quite a few of them around there.
Because
like,
if something was called Sky Zone, that's, if you said to me, oh, I'm going to Sky Zone, that was immediately what my mind went to, was the indoor skydiving place.
So it's a, you know, a big field house. Before this, it was a indoor soccer lacrosse place. Which is an interesting thought in and of itself, which I'll come back to. But so it's that size. Like, okay. It would hold a full size, basically hockey rink style setup,
okay.
Plus a decent amount of space. But now there's three sections that are trampolines, like, and they're not super big trampolines. They're like, picture they're, I'm going to say they're.
But the ones you have out in the garden.
Not as big as the big round. Like, they're rectangles, but they're not as big as the ones you'd see in, like, the Olympics or something like that.
Okay.
But, and they're, you know, because they can't make one big trampoline. Like, it covers a large amount of space. You know, like, there's, like, 20 trampolines in a row. Like, the whole floor is made of separate trampolines, and they have to have borders between them, you know, you can't have one big long trampoline, nobody will bounce on it.
Yeah,
right, it's got to have individual patches. And then on the side, on an angle, basically steeper than a 45 degree angle, they basically have trampoline walls. So you can bounce off the side in there. And there's one really big court like that, and then two smaller courts. And the big one is just sort of free people bouncing around, and you can bounce from spot to spot across the whole room. And then the smaller ones are for dodgeball, like trampoline dodgeball. One is for ages 13 and up, and one is for below 13-year-olds.
Okay.
Then they have a couple of trampolines that lead up to different height baskets, so you can slam dunk in the basket. And then they have a couple of trampolines that go into a foam pit, so you can just dive off and do flips, and you don't have to worry about landing on your feet, because it doesn't matter how you land. And then they have a section that's sort of a small version of like an American Ninja Survivor course, where you like – there actually isn't really a lot of trampoline to that. It's more like the pieces that you're hanging on with a foam pit underneath it.
Now, how is this area sort of policed? Because I now envision this large area.
A plethora of high schoolers.
Because what I mean, is it just people running wild, or is it like a course where you go over here and activity?
It's just open for you, whatever
you move
your time
to the
is.
Next area, or is it just people running everywhere? I'm going to go.
It's interesting. You know, they had a whole bunch of rules there that I don't think they necessarily follow, but they were preserving. So, for example, like, I think everybody comes on in 15 minutes. Every 15 minutes, new people come in. Like, you basically pay for anywhere between a half an hour to an hour and a half. And then the blocks are, they give you a tag, like a ski tag almost, a stick on that just starts in 15 minutes. But they I think they give you group letters. And then when you looked at some signs, they seem to suggest, oh, if you're in group A, you should rotate through the things like this.
Okay, that's what I was
saying.
But
they didn't really police that. It wasn't very crowded. So pretty interesting. I mean, first, like, so because there's all trampolines, it's all off the ground. So even though this was on the floor, obviously they can't have all the trampolines on the floor because it has to have space underneath.
Yeah.
You know, so they have everything's up in the air. There's a lot of hardware involved in this, is my point. And so the fact that a place that had indoor lacrosse, indoor soccer, it's just there, you charge people by the hour for leagues and things like that. Somebody must have decided this doesn't make enough money. Or doesn't make money, or whatever it was that they decide to either sell it or turn it over to that. In other words, somebody had to invest way more money in this than you have to invest in the building in the first place.
Yeah, because
certainly way more staffing, and because you've got like kids, like they're all high schoolers. It's like high schoolers, like at each one of these places, they'd have multiple staffers watching over, making sure nobody does anything inappropriate and moving along. They had a greeter in the front. They got people who like check you in. They got somebody running lockers so you can put your things in there and the like.
I was going to say that sort of owning one of these facilities or renting one of these facilities, I'm sure that with the indoor sports league model, it's sort of maxed out, not in terms of interest, but in terms of it has a revenue ceiling. You can only get so many leads through there. Whereas I would imagine that from a business perspective, if you're like, we need to make more money, something like this, and I was immediately thinking of, I've never done it myself, but having like, you know, a roller skating rink. Well, I guess the notion is, well, we can funnel all kinds of people through here. And so our revenue ceiling is potentially higher than sort of the league ceiling where, it's $500 a team.
Well, that's the one thing I wonder about because, so if you're playing indoor lacrosse or indoor soccer, your teams have 10 people at best on them or something like that. You know, I think assuming you've got 5 or 6 on the court. I mean, I think for the little kids leagues, they probably have more on there. But you've got a certain number of people and they occupy that space for an hour.
Yes.
And so, unless you're going to charge them a fortune. Meanwhile, this is charging for half an hour was $20.
That league fee is set.
A half an hour.
It costs what it costs to put your team in.
Half an hour a person is $20. And then each marginal cost of additional half hours or less. So like a half an hour was $20, but like an hour was $30 or something, maybe not even $26, something like that. And then if you brought it, because it was Thanksgiving, if you brought a donation of food, you got like a free half hour.
Oh, there you go.
So
hopefully you weren't chucking turkeys and cans of beetroot and cranberry sauce around the trampolines, although that could be one of those activities.
Right.
So avoid getting hit.
Fairly interesting.
So how long did you spend out there?
Well, you didn't really ask me the original question, which is what you're asking now. I didn't actually go on it.
Oh, you didn't? Because you're a man of indeterminate middle age.
Well, so I mean, it was Frankie, interesting. So I was. So it was myself, my brother, my sister-in-law, and the kid and their kids, right? And their kids are 9 and 12 or 13.
That's who I'm imagining.
So I go there, and I was prepared to go on. You know, like I wasn't wearing like, you know, workout shorts or things like that, but I was wearing something that would have been comfortable to jump around.
Bounce
there.
Around for
so long. As we arrived there, and they got online, I said, "Let me just go check something." And so I made a little circuit around the place, and there was one guy, one father, who was clearly in that middle age, and he was sort of bouncing in place on one of the things. But everybody else was younger, really. I mean, they were certainly teens and maybe a couple 20-year-olds or something like that. But there were not a lot of older people.
Nice kids,
and so I circled around. Well, I think it's probably different times. Like, they have a night version with, like, flashing strobe lights and things.
And alcohol?
I didn't see alcohol. They did have, like, a little bar thing in the corner. But I don't think they serve booze. But, you know, I imagine they wouldn't put booze because they had all these extra rules.
I don't know. I don't know trampolining.
Like a bunch of the signs said, when they're doing the strobe lights, you're not allowed to flip on the various equipment because you won't really be able to tell what's up and down as well because it's going to be dark in there.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, so I was like, I'm going to take a pass. But my brother and sister-in-law decided to go, and it was fine. And they're actually filtered in a few more. Not, I would have been the oldest person on, and I think they might have been the oldest people on as long as they were on there. But then a couple of, like, They appeared to be like 24-year-old uncles because they knew some kids, but they didn't seem to be their kids, right? Like the way they were dealing with these kids, they were sort of like, oh, they had come from the family there. And these, I could tell one of, so you have to wear these socks, special socks.
Okay.
Because obviously you can't, you know, wear your sneakers on there. Meanwhile, they want something that's got a grip to it, but it's soft and it's not going to damage anything. So you buy the socks for $3 and you get to keep them. But one of the young adults, I'm going to guess they were 23, 4, something like that. They were socks from the facility, but different socks than everybody else had. Like, they had a different pattern, and I'm like, that guy owns his own socks. Like, he's been here before. And as soon as the two guys got there, they immediately went out there, and they were like, picked a spot on the trampoline, and they were immediately going 10 feet high. Like, they were like, they knew exactly what was going on. There was no problem for them. So it wouldn't have been totally out of place, but it was like I did not end up going on.
Yeah, I have never been a trampoline guy. And I do have this sense. Like if you say to me trampoline, or if there's a trampoline featured on a commercial or on a TV show, it is immediately, you know, boys and girls from the age of 5 to 15 who apparently, I was never one of these kids, apparently they'll bounce around all day.
Yeah.
Me, I'm not so sure about that. And because I was never one of those kids, even as an adult, I'm not going to be overcome by this wave of nostalgia that if you said to me, hey, let's go to Trampoline City, I'm not going to go, oh yeah, I'm with you. Let me see if I've got my old socks from back in the day. It's just not my thing. Because again, you're just bouncing around.
Yeah.
But that's me. I'm not a trampoline. Fun. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
I took a lot of pictures of the kids. But
my point here, I do feel like kids then go out on one of these things for hours.
Also, they end up going out for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And my brother was like, had really worked up a sweat at some point. And he's like, I'll take a rest.
And your brother, bless him, he may have been hurting the next day.
Yeah.
He would have been straining and I shouldn't have trampolined for 45 minutes.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know.
So it's fairly entertaining. So anybody wants, I gather that this must be a growing trend. I'm sure there's some around here because.
Was this place busy?
Granted, it's Friday after Thanksgiving afternoon. So you'd think I would consider that to be a busy, certainly going to be busier than a regular Friday.
How long has this place been open? Were you away?
You know,
how long has it been in this?
Can't be iteration? More. It's got to be about a year because I had been there before when it was a lacrosse thing for other family members playing lacrosse there.
Well, this is clearly a model that's financially successful.
Well, I assume so.
I mean, I guess, you know, everything is up front in terms of.
It was very perfect, like the color schemes and the logos. It was not like somebody had just invented this on their own.
Yeah.
So I'm imagining it's either a franchise or a chain or something like that. It was pretty well organized, or somebody knew what they were doing.
What was it called again?
Sky Zone.
Sky Zone. Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll look it up and figure out about that. Yeah. Yeah. So there you go. There was your Thanksgiving. So this was post turkey.
Yeah, so that's Friday afternoon.
That dog meat was
Friday evening.
Around, like,
we
no
went out to
business.
Dinner.
Okay.
You know, after nobody wants
post trampoline.
Yeah, like I mean, you could theoretically stay home and have the leftovers on Friday night, but nobody really wants to have them again at that point.
You got to get out.
So we typically go out. We went out to a restaurant, and then we had come back, and Virginia, University of Virginia, had two games on national TV at the same time. Basketball was in the NIT preseason tournament, which is really just four teams, but their final was at 7:30 that night, and Virginia was playing Virginia Tech. In football at 8 o'clock that
which
night.
Which I watched a little bit of.
So I went back, and the kids don't watch a lot of TV, you know, and the niece and nephew don't watch a lot of TV, and so anytime the TV's on, they like totally are zoned in on everything, like commercials and everything. And I turned on the TV when we came back, and I turned on the football, and they were like, oh, we should watch something else. I'm like, no, not happening. We were watching the football. You can do something else if you'd like, but
I'm sure they were thrilled that their uncle was in town to watch.
They are nice enough to ask who we're rooting for, you know, and I explain which team it is that matters. And because they're playing Virginia Tech, who's VT, somebody thought there was Vermont, you know, but I had to explain that was not actually Vermont. It was Virginia Tech. And, of course, you know, nobody actively rooting against my team, which is something I might do if I had relatives who were rooting for a team just, you know, out of spite.
Yeah, I can see that.
But they root for it. It's a very interesting dynamic whenever you get together.
Well, I was about to ask
people who root, like, they want to root for your team to help you out, but they're not really rooting for your team because they have a thing going on with it. So they're either like
they're
passive. Rooting,
they're supporting you.
Right.
They're supporting you in this experience. Right.
So I have certain family members and or other people do this all the time. When you ever watch somebody sporting it and they, that didn't happen, right? Oh, why are they doing it that way? And I, you know, you can't really take it that seriously because they're not actually invested in the team.
It's actually, I find it quite irritating because then I feel like I need to start explaining stuff.
Yeah.
And my fan experience is not to explain it to other people. It's to have a very emotional, visceral experience myself.
Yeah.
And if I'm busy explaining to someone else something, then I can't be yelling abuse at the TV, which is what I want to do as a fan. Right. Normally at my own team, frankly.
You
know, I watched Arsenal on TV, and I spent most of the time telling my own players to get off the field, you moron, even on the TV. But that's the experience. I don't want to explain to some, like if someone goes to me, oh, why do you want to keep yelling at him to get off the field? Marshall's going to be, because he's crap. And then I'm going to go back to yelling at the TV. It's not an explaining experience to me.
Yeah.
It's an emotional experience.
Yeah. Well, I guess I don't mind the explaining.
Hey, why don't you go out in the yard and play on the trampoline? Let me watch the game.
Well, it's very late. 8 o'clock at night.
Well, whatever. No strobe, no foul.
Yeah. So that was kind of it. You know, did the drive. Always a pleasure. Doing like 9 hours of driving back and forth.
Well, it's funny, I had a sports experience similar to your relatives. A couple of weeks ago, the week before Thanksgiving, I'd gone up to Boston, and I'd gone to Fenway Park to watch one of the games in, they have a name for him, it's called the Gridiron Series.
Wait, what's it?
Yeah, apparently they have a number of games.
Well, what's that? You mean Fenway? So Fenway's series of games.
I'm not quite sure, and you probably need to do much. Should have done my research before the show. But I think some Ivy League teams had also played some games earlier.
In the current year?
In this current year. Like Harvard had played a game.
What'd you call it?
There.
The Grid?
I think it was called Fenway Park Gridiron Series. And anyway, I'd gone to watch Boston College against UConn. Two teams of middling to crap abilities.
BC's decent this year.
They're middling. They're set right now after this week, they're 7-5. So they're middling. UConn are dire. They're like 2-9.
Yeah.
But UConn being about an hour and a half from Boston, Fenway holds, I think, about 38,000. Because it was lashing down with rain, it ended up with only about 19,000 in there. And about 60-70% of them were all UConn fans. Apparently, because UConn is a very large state.
So included in the Fenway Gridiron Series looks like about 5 days.
Yeah.
Dartmouth versus Brown.
There you go.
University of Maine versus UMass.
Yep.
Boston College versus UConn.
Yep.
And then we go to high school. BC High versus Catholic Memorial. And then a high school football doubleheader.
So it was my first time in Fenway Park, which I'd done a bit of research. I think it was built in like the 1910s. I think so. I looked online.
Yeah.
I don't know. There is a sense when
it
you
opened
go,
in 1912.
Sorry, 1912.
Fenway Park has a long history of football dating back to its opening in 1912. The ballpark was commonly transformed to the gridiron for high school and college football games throughout the early 20th century. It was the home to the Boston Patriots from 63 to 68.
Okay. I mean, it was kind of cool to go. It is an interesting... There is this notion of... It is a historic building. I mean, it's a sports stadium that's over 100 years old, which actually is quite rare when you consider that, who is it? The Atlanta Falcons just built a new stadium. Their prior stadium seemed to last about 17 years. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas this thing has been relatively unchanged in a century. It did remind me of going to Arsenal's old stadium, Highbury, when I was a kid, which again was built around the same time. So there is this feeling that you're walking into an historic building.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Fenway Park, it's right downtown in Boston. You know, like you can't see it around the city blocks, and then it's right there.
Right,
like you sort of see the sky lit up by the floodlights. It's all brick and sort of cast iron posts and wooden, very uncomfortable seats that are very tight. And
were you in the UConn or the BC section? I'm looking at a map here. I think the way you described it.
We were technically in the UConn section,
right.
Although I would say that the majority, even though the game was in Boston, like I say, it was UConn's home game, so it was UConn's band and UConn's announcer.
Yeah, it looks like UConn had a lot more seats.
They did. I think it was technically their home game, although, you know, my guesstimate, when I looked online the next day, I think I went to like ESPN or something to look at the game stats. I think the attendance was listed as something like 18,000. So on a night where it was just team and rain for about 4.5 hours, there was definitely a sense that Fenway Park was not full.
Mm-hmm.
It was a neat experience to visit. And I'm not one of those sort of geeko guys who gets open. No, I think I am when it comes to like stadiums. I am like, oh, wow, this is cool. Oh, wow, I've been there. Yes, I've been to Old Wembley and New Wembley. I know we've had that. Mm-hmm. These discussions on this show. So I do feel like, yeah, I've been to somewhere historic. And there is this interesting notion when you're there, you're almost sort of transported back in time to like, you know, everyone in flat caps and all this. Do you know what I mean? You do sort of feel that a little bit. It is relatively unchanged, other than I would say the bathrooms and then the prices. The bathrooms are very nice.
This is a nighttime game, wasn't it?
Nighttime game, yeah.
So like they're not used to have lights, but...
I guess it is a complaint. It was really expensive. All your concessions, it was more expensive than going to... You and I have been to Washington National games together. Yeah. I go to Georgetown Ohio basketball games. I've been to the occasional NBA game in D.C. You know, beers, hot dogs. You were paying more than a premium. Mm-hmm. I was shocked at how expensive it was. And I couldn't tell if this was... just for this event where it was a quick gouge and fleecing up a load of people like me who are like, yeah.
Well, in college football usually doesn't have beer to begin with, so maybe
well, yeah, because it was a public stadium. So I don't know if the prices were in line with what it normally was. I think my takeaway from it, the actual stadium, like I say, the seats are wood and iron, and when you sit, our group was on the lower tier, so there was a tier above us.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in these old stadiums, those tiers are not sort of cantilever style.
Right.
There are large posts every like 20 feet that hold the, you know, that stop the upper level from crashing into the lower level.
Right.
And what it means is there's no such thing as an unobstructed view. Doesn't matter where you sit, at least for football.
Yeah.
And I would imagine for baseball.
But sure, well, for baseball, yeah, at least like, you know, when you're looking at home plate in the pitcher, you can have most of the time on him. Whereas the field in football is going to come 25%
of the action, you're probably going to miss. It's going to occur behind your obstructed view of the post, unless you're in front of the post. But of course, what that means is you're then going to be outside, and on a night like this, you are going to be getting drenched, wet. I'm glad I went. I'm not entirely convinced, and I've sat with you at the Washington Nationals, and I've sat with you in the nice seats. I've sat in the cheap seats at the Washington Nationals. That ballpark is what, 15 years old?
Not even.
I mean, yeah. So very modern. So we're now.
I think I'm wearing the shirt.
It 2008. Your shirt is saying to me. So it is. It is. Yeah, it's less than a decade old. So obviously, this is an extremely unfair comparison. But you know something? That's the point of the comparison. I'm not sure. I would be a lot more tentative about investing in Fenway Park season tickets just for the fact like it's not a very comfortable couple of hours.
Yeah, you know, well, I think they rely on the fact that the people who are Red Sox fans are going to go all the time. Like it's just a thing, you know, people are supposed to be so wildly into it that you'll put up with the stuff because you'll really want to see it. I mean, that's a big difference for you. Like for you.
I was a tourist.
Yeah, totally a tourist.
That's true. Like, so that becomes totally a suddenly different experience. So I was there taking photos with my phone. And it is interesting, you know, when you walk in off the street, you know, unlike modern stadiums that have these bright, open shopping mall, food court style concourses, you know, Fenway Park, it's just like you are permanently walking down a narrow corridor.
Yeah, yeah. Like Boston College's stadium's like that too. I was there a few years. Like underneath the bleachers, it's very much like you're really, you know, low ceilings. None of these recent designs where everything's all open.
That is kind of cool, and it is part of the atmosphere. But I'm not entirely convinced that if I had a 14-game season ticket package, I'm not sure. You know, at some moment, I don't know. I think the more you go, the less the history means something to you.
Mm-hmm.
Although I can't imagine you'd ever find a Red Sox fan sitting here going, oh, I want a new stadium. Although I am actually
sure. They did. Back in the day, that was the talk before the new ownership took over, that was that they needed a new stadium. And the folks who took it over said, no, we can tune this up enough that we're going to put a better product on the field than everybody's.
Well, it is interesting, too. You do get a sense, you know, because we got in there quite early.
Was anybody sitting on the Big Green Monster? Or was there?
There were seats on top of the Big Green Monster. There were some people sitting up there, okay. But because it's wide open and it rained nonstop, it was a cold.
And that's about like looking at the diagram. That looks like the field basically ran along the first baseline, and that's the left. So you were like not only way high in the air, but you'd be really far away from the field.
Also interesting too, they had to put they put both teams on the same sideline in front of the Green Monster, which was interesting.
Yeah,
and I'm sure may have been slightly confusing for some of the players. I don't know. I mean,
it had to be. I mean, running sub. Because, you know, normally the team has a full run of the edge there.
And again, it was neither one of these teams is, you know, going to the college football playoffs. Yeah. UConn especially not. I mean, I think they're like 3-9 now. So it was pretty miserable football.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say this, and you know, the band sounded good in a tight old stadium like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like it is small and quite intimate. And... yeah, I'm glad I remember I've stood outside. I've stood outside Wrigley Field, and I've now been to Fenway Park.
Right.
But to be fair, if I went back to Boston and someone said, "Oh yeah, we're going to the game," yeah, if I'm there, I go as a one-off. But I think if I lived up there, I wouldn't be falling over myself to pay. Because I went to
one baseball game there probably 18 years ago, and I'm sure
during baseball season. You know, you're not paying flat cap era prices. You're still paying top of the line dollar to go because it's a smaller stadium. At a certain level, I'm not sure I'd feel so great about paying high end prices to sit in an uncomfortable seat and get charged a lot for my concessions. But there you go. There was a bit of history.
What else did you do in Boston? Anything of note?
No, ate, shopped. Just not too much. Like, only up there for like 48 hours.
Like really good. Did you go to?
Went to one really good restaurant.
I forgot what the Little Italy version is called up there.
I know what you're talking about. We did not do that.
Okay.
No. And we were almost going to get some chowder, but we decided instead let's eat in Fenway Park. Let's make the Fenway Park experience the full-on thing.
Yeah.
And just really expensive. But I couldn't decide if that's Fenway Park or if that was just sort of to do a bit of gouging on one of these one-off games.
Did you take the tea to the ball game or how did you get there?
We actually drove and parked we parked one block away in the Target. There's a Target right mm-hmm. next door, so you park underneath. And that is the interesting thing about Fenway Park. And I think a lot of old soccer stadiums, definitely in the United Kingdom, they are right in the city. I remember, like I said, I remember going to Highbury when I was a kid, and you walk around the houses and it's right there. And if you walk one street over, you don't know it's there. Whereas I know nowadays, if you go to, you know, the Redskins or a New York Giants, or I think the Patriots up there, they're playing in these big places that are surrounded by acres of parking lot, and you can see it from miles away.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there is something about, Fenway Park's right downtown.
Yeah.
And there were people shopping in the Target, completely oblivious to the fact that there was a game on. So there is something about that, yeah.
Yeah, they probably don't care about the BC game.
No, no. Yeah, and frankly, if you're a UConn fan... Well, I don't know. They all seem to come in droves and...
Well, yeah. If you're a UConn alum, it's pretty good. I mean, listen, if your team is horrible and gives you opportunity to go to this is sort of a fun trip, I'm sure.
I'm sure it was a fun trip because, you know, something? Their team is horrible.
Yeah.
Interception. And I decided to be a BC fan for the night. So I took great pleasure sitting in the UConn section.
Yeah, like we said, sort of spite rooting.
A little bit spite rooting. Yeah. Although, frankly, looking at some of those fellas up there, that could have led me into dangerous waters. But... But yeah, so there you go, my Fenway Park experience.
All right then.
So it was built in 1912.
That's what it, well, opened in 1912, I don't know.
Did you know that was the same year that the Titanic sank?
What a segue. We didn't even know that was coming.
Yeah, I just made that up. To be fair.
Is it true?
It was 1912. It was April the 17th, I think, 1912.
Mm-hmm.
On one of our shows about a year ago, we actually talked about the sinking of the Titanic in depth. Because remember, we'd watched that video reproduction. That video
simulation. That's right. The real time thing.
Go to the Atlantic Voice website and just type Titanic in the search bar and you can listen to that episode. So we're not here to talk about the Titanic sinking.
No, the Titanic movie.
The Titanic movie, which just, as you pointed out to me, is 20 years old this month.
Yeah, the Post ran a little in their style section for today.
Stephanie Merry, we will shout her out. She wrote an article and then there was another article by...
Bethany Butler ran a thing that's little bits and pieces, like talking about, you know, how did these things hold up?
It's quite a good, interesting discussion.
Yeah.
It really made me think about it today when I read all this.
You know, as a cultural item, you know, it's so such a big movie, and for a segment of people who, like, as the woman, who was the woman that you mentioned?
Stephanie Mary.
So she was mentioning that, you know, she's 16 years old, and, like, if you're a 16-year-old girl when this movie came out with Leo, young Leo.
Well, she was a Titanic movie Spite fan.
Right, right. But meaning, like, her, she was basically saying that she was right in the wheelhouse of people that was supposed to be, like, the most amazing thing ever for. And she didn't really like it because I think she's basically saying it wasn't. There was a lot of great real stories to have to make this fictional story about this couple was annoying to
her. Yeah, I thought her argument was kind of weak, frankly. You know,
she had a family connection. She had
somewhat
attenuated, but person who is actually who actually survived that the little story about the person surviving sound pretty good. But
I don't know, but you can make it. And while I understand that, and I don't want to put a boot into Stephanie Mary, but I do feel that you can then apply that. You can then apply that rule to any film about an historical era, and then pre-decide that it's not worth it.
Yeah.
Now, okay, we talked the other week on our scorecard roundup. We talked about Dunkirk. Now, you could easily apply that rule, well, you know, the history of it, and sort of immediately dismiss the movie. I'm not entirely convinced that's a good argument to have. Do you know what I mean? Oh, you can take any war movie.
Yeah, well, but it's a little different. Like the Dunkirk, the part which apparently somebody just explained, I guess we're pronouncing this differently. It's British would say Dunkirk, whereas everybody here is saying Dunkirk.
I don't know. I've lived here for 30 years.
Yeah. Well, you just said Dunkirk.
Dunkirk.
Like the accent was on the second part. Anyway. But that was, there were fictional stories within the plot of it. I think the point is this was a weird fiction. It was a love story grafted onto the event. So, right. Like, the event was a backdrop. And so I think what they were saying.
All right. So let's talk 20 years of the Titanic. And I want
to
show.
Also, out of the articles, if you go to the Washington Post, it's got them all there. And they had a thing about Celine Dion's song and, like, you know, you love it or hate it. And,
So let's do this then to have this conversation. Let's put the cultural stuff second. Because 20 years, because to me there are two different topics.
Yeah, I'm waiting to hear what the first one is.
Well, the first one is how does this movie hold up 20 years later?
Yeah,
and then culturally, what does it mean 20 years later? Because I do think I'm not gonna spoil my own opinion.
Yeah,
I do think you can make a case for it culturally 20 years later. As a film, I'm going to tell you, I don't think it holds up 20 years on.
Well, first, did you see it in the theaters originally?
Yes.
Oh wow.
No, I went. I think I went. I went the second week.
I mean, I'm not even totally sure that I've seen it all the way through in one sitting ever.
I've seen it in the cinema.
Like, I've seen all the chunks at some point on cable, but I don't think I've ever, like, sat down and watched it.
Everything comes back to James Bond. So I do remember Titanic and the Pierce Brosnan James Bond movie Tomorrow Never Dies came out on the same day.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, right there, my choice was Titanic, which I was definitely wanted to see, and James Bond. Forget it. I can only bail out of work one Friday, like once on a Friday.
Right.
I bailed out of work, as is my tradition, to go and see the James Bond movie as close to when it came out as it did. I do remember Pierce Brosnan.
Did you have to get your Big Fella Movies review in?
Yes, and that's a different topic. I do remember Pierce Brosnan, who's not my famous Bond, not my favorite Bond. He was quoted as the time, because he was slightly concerned that Tomorrow Never Dies' box office would be hurt by the mega ship that was Titanic.
Yeah.
He actually tried to make the statement that our underwater scenes are going to be as good as anything at Titanic. And I think he did that firmly with his tongue in his cheek because he knew.
Yeah.
So anyway, the first Friday I'd gone to see Tomorrow Never Dies because it's James Bond. And then sometime the following week, I went to see Titanic. And I must say, as a cinema experience, and this was before IMAX and all that type of thing, I was ready not to like the movie. I was very impressed with it when I walked out with it.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the actual sinking of the Titanic.
Yeah, out of the whole thing, I would say the sinking part is the best part of it. The story, the love story is a little kitschy.
Well, I want to come back to. I'm going to come back to. I do think I'm going to come back to that, which is sort of the. I think that's the gist of some of the criticisms about the film. The sinking of the Titanic is done. I mean, he used real water and apparently the set he used was a 90% what do you call it, scale.
Right.
So it was 9/10 the size of the real one. They used a massive water tank studio, I think off the coast of Mexico, to film it. So when you watch the film Titanic, you know, there are a couple of moments where you go, ooh, that's a special effect. But I was impressed with it as spectacle in the, wow, he did it for real and it looks really, really good. And even when there are clearly special effects, it doesn't get in the way of this notion that, yeah, I put 300 extras into the water for 6 hours. Then hats off to that as a film-going experience. So I was impressed with it from that aspect. I do remember when he won the Oscar, because I want to get back to this about him winning the Oscar, which I think people forget. That movie won like 11 Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
I think it also got the Oscar for writing or script or something. And James Cameron had said all the way along that when he decided to do Titanic, right up front, he had to create the right script for it. Meaning he couldn't just do the sinking of the Titanic.
Yeah, well,
he had to graft another story in there in order for it to elevate it as a piece of art, because I think his position was everyone knows it's going to sink. So there's no suspense there. So I have to create suspense somehow. And he grafted on, and I think in one of his quotes, he used Dr. Zhivago, one of the greatest movies of all time, as an example. I decided to graft in a love story in order to give my the boat sink spoiler.
Mm-hmm.
You know, otherwise, he didn't want it to feel like a documentary. I must say, at the time, it works. You get away with it. First time through, you get away with it. 20 years later, upon repeated viewing, it is, to be fair, it does get in the way of the film. That's my position 20 years on. At the time, I wasn't that offended by it. I didn't care.
I mean, like, as you watch it, I would have never...
I mean, to me, it was like, do they both die? Do they both live? Whatever. I get that. I get suspense. I get sort of the beats of the story at the time. It definitely didn't interfere with my experience first time through. 20 years later, what do I care?
I did wonder at the time it came out, though, why did you have to do the bit about the flash forward, all the element of framing it in like this old woman going out there and still having a necklace and holding a candle for these stuff, like, and Bill Paxton, good excuse, but Bill Paxton in a movie, but you didn't need that. Why not just tell it from the beginning about this whole thing? You could even have had at the end something about the woman getting old and never having given up. But why did you have to have the whole bit about like, oh, we're sending the undersea sub down there to get a hold of it?
I don't know. I think it works.
That's like a James Cameron thing.
Yeah, it is. But I think it worked. Well, I think he also wanted to go, look, we actually went to the real Titanic. There is that sort of gee whiz, this is what the budget's gone towards.
That part, I think, was lame to begin with, and even lamer now.
Well, that's the thing. I think he did want to have it both ways. He wanted to have something that you could watch as a documentary, but then, again, he had to find a way to fuse them all together. And first time through, I kind of feel like he got away with it. I think second time, 20 years later, when you watch it, you have a pretty hackneyed, hokey love story that's ultimately of soap opera level.
Well, yeah, I guess. I mean, I guess when you watch it the first, because you watch it the first time through,
it's all very predictable.
The point is, he had to build in suspense. He builds in the suspense of the love story, but when you watch it a second time, it's not a suspenseful love story because you know where it's all going there. Yeah. So, like, each one of its turns seems like, gee.
And it's all a bit cliched,
and then, of course, that's part of the memes and things that, you know, the I'm flying and the king of the world stuff and I'll never let go. I guess, you know, the whole thing with he's floating on the door, like, people have done science, I didn't realize that, but people have done the big talk, I guess, people who want to have a little cultural conversations about something weird.
Because this is now the instinct. Because my position on the cultural thing is now different.
Right. So, one of the things is people who follow it as like a big deal, but then other people who parse over the movie more, you know? And so the door that she's floating on. So at the end of the movie, anybody who hasn't seen it, I'm not giving anything away, but they go into the water. They don't have life vests. So they find a floating wooden door.
Oh, is it a door? I just thought it was something in the water.
No, it's a door. Oh, so okay. She gets up on it and he can't get out and onto the door. And so he ends up freezing to death, holding onto her hand there at the door while he's in the water, but she's on the door safe. And a lot of people are like, why didn't he get on the door? It's a big door. And so apparently Cameron's been forced to sort of answer the fact that it was really a question of buoyancy, not size of the door. and then to the point where people are like, I guess the Mythbusters people ran an experiment with a door of that size and said it could hold two people.
You know something?
And James, so like,
Cameron doesn't need to explain to you. As much as I've just criticized.
No, that's pretty fun. That's pretty fun. So James Cameron basically said, listen, the plot was he had to die. So if I made the door too big, my apologies. No, I could have just done it smaller. No, and the point was that the door couldn't
don't
hold him
apologize.
Up. And then there's a whole thing, I guess, where she says she'll never let go. And then very shortly thereafter, she lets go when he freezes to death, which it's not really a real plot hole, but people have like sort of played that element up of, I guess if you go onto the internet, you could find things about people promising to do things and then not doing them. And they, you know, they'll make the little moving picture with suddenly you're above these kind of kitschy stuff. Look at our entire podcast is about this kind of crap.
Well, what I'm going to say is, well, in a strange way though, to your point, culturally, the film, unlike the real Titanic, clearly holds water 20 years on. The people over the last 20 years.
Well, it's because it's such a marker. It's kind of like we talked about Jurassic World being so big for some segment of people, not us, but Jurassic Park.
But here's the interesting thing. Jurassic Park still holds up as a film. Now, my criticisms of Jurassic Park not being as good as the book, their criticisms now, they were criticisms in 1993. But what I'm saying is, my opinion of Jurassic Park, the film, has not changed. It is what it is, which is a solid...
I just mean culture. I'm back on the culture.
No, but what I'm saying is, Titanic is not as good film now as it was 20 years ago. But culturally, I do agree with you, it continually resonates at a level that perhaps it shouldn't. And, I mean, I'll say this. What I find most fascinating is how neither DiCaprio nor Winslet, they've always put on a brave face and they've never run from it that some movie stars might have.
What do you mean?
No, but they've always they've acted together on many occasions. So clearly there was a good professional partnership formed on that film. Because remember, at the time, she was pretty much unknown and he was a teen heartthrob.
Yeah.
He's not Leo DiCaprio now of Revenant and like, Oscars and all this kind of stuff.
His head got a lot bigger since then. I don't mean metaphor. I mean literally. Like his head. Like he's like when he was like a younger. I mean, this is 20 years ago, so it's not an ancient. But like, there's a thing about Leo DiCaprio though. Like people tend to say he looks still boyish, but he looks like Barry Bonds in his steroid phase. Like all these like features have like swollen up.
Makes you wonder if perhaps if he'd been older when he'd been on the ship, he might have floated. Yeah, No, but I do find it interesting. They have sort of embraced is the wrong word, but I never get that. You know, I sometimes feel and I like DiCaprio a lot, but I sometimes feel that, and again, I'm now going to sort of project onto him. If he'd spent 20 years trying to sort of talk down his teen heartthrob phase, I could have understood that. Because I want to be taken seriously as an actor, right? But to his credit, both he and her, they've always been very upfront. Yeah, we were in this thing and it was a monster. And sure, it's hokey. And the movie's success was floated by armies of teenage girls. They've never run from it.
I imagine if I'm Leo, you know, Leo is known for having an active romantic life. I imagine he would never run from this because this is like his in with 50% of the female population that would have covered that. Well, it's still like, listen, you know, if he was to suddenly deny the value of that,
sure,
then,
yeah,
but, you know, he's ruined the prime.
So, but what I'm saying, he's been a good sport about it.
Yeah. Well,
but you can easily see other actors trying to sort of.
Well, I'm trying to think of what are the examples. I can think of one, but I'm going to. What is the example of somebody who'd been in a movie that big with a Oscars and then they turned and said, oh, I'm not going to embrace that movie that I played in.
Well, there's plenty of people who've run from their parts, though. Michael Keaton was done quickly with Batman. Sean Connery couldn't wait to get away from James Bond. You know, I'm trying to think of.
Yeah, but I don't know if they ever denied the value of it. Like, you know, like it's not like Sean Connery was like, oh, I never should have done those Bond movies.
No, but I do think there are actors who sometimes want to be remembered for more than just one film. And to be fair,
The only thing I could think of is maybe Kristen Stewart in the Twilight movies, but maybe, that's not, but that's the Twilight movies are cultural phenomena. It's not movie making phenomena.
Yeah, I don't know. I find it interesting. Like I say, I mean, you know, I do feel that if you're, you know, and Winslet's different because she's come from that sort of British stage background where you sort of trend straight into like indie movies and stuff anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas DiCaprio, I could imagine, I mean, if you look at his body of work since, it's very few things that he does. He does everything for art's sake. He worked with Christopher Nolan in Inception. That was as blockbustery as a decision as you get from Leo DiCaprio. He's made a whole load of movies with Martin Scorsese that while they've made a ton of money, they are art before anything else. You know, he's done, even him and Kate Winslet, they've been in a couple of movies since. One of them was, I think it was Revolutionary Road with Sam, directed by Sam Mendes, which was basically a stage play on screen. I mean, what I'm saying is, you know,
it's kind of curious. Is looking up, Leo got $2.5 million for Titanic. I don't know if I can get to, I'm curious as to like at that time, you know, who would have gotten paid more.
Well, Bruce Willis in any Die Hard
movie. No. I mean, on the movie, on this, on like, oh. So, like Kate Winslet got.
I mean, I do think there's a significance. I do think Titanic is an interesting thing in everyone's career, though. Because I've definitely had a sense with...
She got $2 million. So they're very close at that time.
And I definitely have a sense with James Cameron. And I don't know if he said it, so I don't want to put words in his mouth or but then again, if I'm paraphrasing something that he said, then I apologize for not giving him credit for it. I definitely felt like they won all the Oscars. He's got that famous... You know, he made that "I'm the king of the world" speech type thing.
He has expressed regret over that.
But regardless of that, though, he's done one movie since. He did Avatar, and that's it. And I do feel for Cameron that his career as a film director just sort of ended. It was like that was the climax of it. And he'd been on this great upward arc. You know, he'd done the Terminator movies. He'd done Aliens. You know, there was this notion... You know, and then he went to do Titanic, and I remember all this discussion about, you know, he's not just artistic, he's one of the leading edges in, you know, technical. And then he went and did the 3D thing with Avatar, and then that's been it for James Cameron. I mean, he spent a lot of time off doing underwater photography of the Titanic,
right,
after Titanic. It was interesting, like, he sort of had this career, Titanic had him do a career left turn, rather than... You know, you're right. He's the king. He was the king of the world. He could have done anything he wanted in Hollywood, had a couple of goes. He could have made a couple of bombs and still come back and done more. And yet, in a strange way, Titanic is this, it's sort of the peak of his career and almost the end. I know Avatar came after.
Well, and he's got all the other Avatar movies maybe, coming up.
I mean, he did say it was one of the most exhausting things. He put everything into the film. He'd written it himself. It was a huge technical undertaking. Yeah, maybe at that moment, why do I need to do a comedy with, you know, Dave Chappelle and Jon Stewart?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I don't know. But it's interesting how it sort of, boom, that was his career. DiCaprio's gone on to have a massive career on the other side. Well, I was going to say,
like, in terms of salaries relative to them, like, Kate Winslet's still her top end is generally there's a couple of movies she got $5 million on, but Leo gets, like, $30 million, you know?
Yeah, but I think for Winslet, too, though, she's hacked out her very artistic career despite being in Titanic. Oh, despite is the wrong word, but do you know what I mean? Like, she's gone and made the choices that she's needed to make, and she's worked when she's wanted to work. And DiCaprio's gone and done his thing. Whereas I feel like James Cameron, well, that was it. There was nothing more to do after sinking the Titanic.
I imagine he's got some money-making situations.
No, but I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is creatively as someone, he could have written...
I'm not accusing you of saying anything. It's very defensive. But
creatively, he could have written his ticket, and he chose not to cash it in.
Here's the thing. He's not really that... He's not a high art guy.
But he could have, but why not?
Why? What has he done that ever approached something that would have been...
I think Terminator 2 Judgment Day
that's
is
high
arguably...
Art?
It's not high art, but it's one of the greatest science fiction films of ever. Yes, it happens to be an Arnold Schwarzenegger action movie, but if you go online and read it and read what people say about it,
yeah, but
it's I mean, you know, Terminator, some people, oh, yeah, Terminator 2, that's seminal science fiction, blah, blah, blah. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I just feel like he, all of a sudden, he's done Titanic, and then because he's done very little since, he now has one of the shortest filmographies in Hollywood, well, rather
he's got,
than...
He's got all the new Avatars coming out.
Yeah, when? When are they coming out?
I don't know. It's listed on his IMDb. 2, 3, and 4 all, like, lined up on his IMDb.
Yeah, they're lined up, but there's nothing happening with them.
Yeah.
You know, what's interesting, I must confess, I, as much as I liked the film at the time, I do remember at the Oscars that I really, really, really wanted L.A. Confidential to win. And L.A. Confidential didn't. And Titanic won. And yet, and again, you know, appreciation of art is ultimately subjective. I can sit through L.A. Confidential now, and it's as great a movie now with as brilliant performances in it now as it was 20 years ago. Whereas, to our point, watching Titanic now, I'm fast-forwarding until the boat sinks.
Mm-hmm.
But culturally, well, obviously, yeah. Titanic, I do think, so what I'm saying is, a film, I don't think Titanic holds up as a cultural phenomenon, cultural thingy ding. Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
So you've never watched it all the way through.
Well,
this conversation was always never seen. The
I've seen film. All the parts of it. I just haven't seen them all in a row.
Oh, did you? So, and you didn't see it on the big screen?
No.
Yeah. Have you? I mean, it's, I would almost say, I would be interested to see what it looks like on Blu-ray now. And I'm sure, now again, you know, we've talked about that. We both watched the Blade Runner Blu-ray, mm-hmm. and it still looks great on a smaller screen. I would be curious to see what the Titanic Blu-ray looks like.
I'm sure it looks pretty good. I mean,
I don't know. I'm curious.
Yeah.
Do you have no plans to do so?
No.
So you're not going to make
the other little story I was going to tell is that, you know, in terms of people picking over things, is like when they, this is, you know, if you have kids in the car, put their hands over the ears now. But when they hook up in the car and the steamy hand, like, is a hand on a window. And, like, I guess Jezebel is a website that people has apparently done a complete, like, dissemination of trying to figure out what they could have been actually doing, literally, in terms of positioning in the car to have the handprint in that particular way.
Oh yeah, because it's back, because it's her hand, isn't it?
Something like that.
Yeah, she had to have turned her. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. Yeah. And I'm sitting here in the New Basement Studio waving my arms around, attempting to emulate Kate Winslet in coitus.
Yeah.
It's a great spectacle.
Sure.
It's not a great film in its entirety. I mean, like, when you watch the love song, the love story now, it's so cliched. Like, at the time, it's interesting.
What about the song, the Celine Dion song?
I couldn't stand it at the time.
Yeah.
And yet, it's funny, when you hear it, you know, it's one of those things, isn't it? This is the thing about the Titanic. Mm. Everything about that ship sinking continues to resonate. Just affiliate yourself with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we called this the Titanic, the Atlantic Voice Titanic podcast, we'd probably get all kinds of mileage out of this podcast.
Make sure you have that in the title.
Oh, we'll have it in the title.
Like, but Holidays and Titanic.
Yeah, Holidays and Titanic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty awful song. And strange, do they play it in the movie? They do, don't they? It seems strangely incongruent. Like, of all the
Maybe
things,
they must play it in, like, the modern parts. Because I don't think there's any, like, weird modern songs over the historical
No,
parts.
But they do. They do play the melody. There's the famous scene when they're on the front of the boat, and he's yelling. And I think they play.
Like, I don't think Celine Dion's voice comes through in some part there.
But I think she sings it probably over the end credits. Like what I'm saying is people.
Yeah. Well, they could even have it during
the melody runs all the way through the movie. Yeah. I don't think. Oh, maybe some of them. Yeah, some of the modern stuff. Although Celine Dion in 19.
Research.
Celine Dion in 1912 would be incongruent, and frankly, Bill Paxton's character does not strike me as someone in his submarine going down to the wreck of the Titanic, blasting Celine Dion on his way down there. The Rolling Stones, maybe, you know.
Sorry, I'm doing research.
I mean, it's not a great. I don't think it's a great song. To be fair, I didn't think it was a great song at the time. I thought it was overly raw and just over the top, which is the whole point of Titanic. I mean,
Single sold 1.7 million dollar copies.
I mean, it was a massive hit.
Yeah.
I wonder how Celine Dion feels about it.
Oh, I'm sure she loves it.
Does she?
Yeah, I don't think she's got any complaints.
You name any other Celine Dion songs?
I could name any, but I'd recognize them.
No, I'm not asking. Can you name any? So while Leo and Kate are not bothered, lumbered down by Titanic, clearly it put a poleaxe on James Cameron's career, and Celine Dion is like...
You know, she married some producer and then kind of got out of the music biz.
But I'm sure every time she played a concert, she had to play. It's like Barry Manilow has to play Copacabana. Oh, yeah. Rolling Stones have to play Satisfaction.
Somebody in the Thanksgiving was really asking about the Netflix special, Barbra Streisand special. I guess there's a Netflix Barbra Streisand special that they're literally actively promoting on TV.
You know,
get Netflix and watch this Barbra Streisand special.
She's got a fan base.
Oh, yeah.
Man, that's another show.
We were watching one night when I was looking for things to watch. There was on one of the channels. There's like a nostalgia channel that has. I blanked out on the late night host of the old
Johnny Carson. Days.
No, older.
Jack Paar.
Close.
Who was the one? Who was it who did it?
Had the Beatles and everything.
Yeah. Ed Sullivan.
Yeah, right. Ed Sullivan. It had lots of bits from Ed Sullivan all cut together, and they had Barbra Streisand from like the early 50s, and it was kind of funny that was on Netflix. The same time of promoting Netflix, Barbra Streisand, she was on, and she was very, it was a very bouncy song, not what we think of Barbra Streisand type of things now.
Yeah. I can see Barbra Streisand banging out that Celine Dion song.
Oh, sure.
That's a Streisand song.
I bet you they wouldn't want
to. Talking of Ed Sullivan and Johnny Carson, did you happen to see the David Letterman Mark Twain special?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, it was quite amusing.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure it's rerunning on PBS on a regular basis.
Yeah, you'll find it. Yeah, quite amusing. So anyway, there you go.
I think
that's it for this show, right?
I think so. Yeah.
We brought it in on time.
Under an hour, but
which can't be said for the captain of the Titanic.
Yeah.
Okay. So as we said at the start, coming up after this will be our two-part Christmas special. Plenty of stuff. Hopefully, for you to listen to over the holidays. Do you want to tease this year's theme for our listeners? Let's get a bit of excitement.
A very '90s Christmas.
So we'll leave that with you.
Or holiday, I guess.
All right. Don't be one of those below.
But I'm just saying, we're in time.
Christmas.
Wait, I'd be doing the opposite there.
Okay, whatever.
Anyway,
this has been Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric. Take care.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on the Atlantic Voice Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at AtlanticVoice.net. Email us at AtlanticVoice@gmail.com. And now, on YouTube, search for The Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.